My name's Bo and I'm an addict. Yeah, one of the nice things about, can y'all hear me now? Okay. If I get caught up in what I'm talking about and start fading out, do not be subtle. I mean, in the back row, she's still going like that. And subtlety doesn't always work with me. But one of the nice things about these affairs is getting the tears in your eyes, because, you know, it really means that, like, your soul is coming out. I mean, there are other kind of tears. Some tears are not worth shit, you know. But then I think of these as honorable tears, you know, tears of the Spirit. But anyway, no, I don't remember it, but it sounds like the kind of thing that that happens in my life all the time. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad it worked well for you.
Yes, it did. Thank you.
But sometimes I sort of turn my life and my will over to teddy bears, you know. But I'm real picky about which teddy bears. And now, am I supposed to talk about the story of the basic text or in a history?
In a history is Lynn?
Huh? I can't hear worth a toot.
Whatever you want.
Well, okay. I can turn that one over.
Talk about Anthony.
About what?
Talk about Anthony.
Shush.
Cut it out. The thing that's been on my mind pretty much this morning, I think it's Ed McCullough from University of Chicago. I heard a tape on writing history, and he said the important thing to remember about history is that the proponents don't know how it's going to come out. They know they're a soldier. They know they're fighting in a war. They know they may die. But they don't know whether they're going to win or not. And a lot of times they don't even know if the cause that they're fighting for is worth the shit or not. And we're sort of like that. We're members of Narcotics Anonymous. We're not too old as organizations go. A lot of our membership and a lot of our organizational strength has come into play in the last 30 years, you know, 40 years. So I thought it might be best to emphasize that. Oh, and I did want to do something historical just at the front end so it doesn't slip my mind later. The 12th step is real, folks. The 12th step is a platform to a new life. If any of you silly, wonderful recovering addicts are hanging out in a prolonged period of time on step 6 or step 8 or anything like that, just get your higher power to kick your metaphorical ass and move on up to step 12. Because it ain't that hard. The 12 steps are written to be worked by sick, crazy people that are out of their minds. And most of y'all, I'm looking around the room and I don't see a single soul throwing up. If there's a knife wound in the room, I can't see it from here. So we're all doing much better. So, you know, surrendering and finding a belief in loving God and turning your life and your will over and taking your inventory with the help of that God that you just turned your life and your will over to, and then reading the script to somebody and become willing for God to set certain changes in life in your motion, because you don't really need those defects and those defense mechanisms as much. And then you're free inside, and let's see, what's the next step for freedom? Being able to go down to any street in the world and not be worried about who you're going to run into. If you own an amends, you got your amends packaged and ready to deliver. And so you're free to walk down any street in the world. And then the rest is, you know, if you take your inventory well enough, nobody else will have to. And prayer is for now, and meditation goes on forever. Prayer is what you can put into words. Meditation is for what goes beyond words. And if you don't know entirely what that means, then just sit down for as long as you can stand it, at least once a day, and you will find yourself eventually remembering your dreams. You'll eventually find yourself remembering faces, and people that you miss that you could contact, and that's the way you rebuild your life. And it's all about you and getting your happiness and getting your life back. Obsession is losing control of your thinking. Compulsion is losing control of your actions. And when you lose control of your thinking and your actions, you've lost control of your life. So if you understand what I'm talking about, you know, on one level or another, you are at or approaching a spiritual awakening. And what happens then is you stop hating people. You stop fearing people. You stop walking around in shame and guilt and fear and confusion. And you got the kind of lifestyle that lets you take time out for the miracles, you know. And the measure of your life is how many people love you. How many people do you actively love? If you love just a few people, you are impoverished. And if you love many, many people and many, many people love you, then you are very wealthy. That's why I call myself, just to emphasize it, I may be the only spiritual billionaire you'll ever meet. It ain't about money at all. And Narcotics Anonymous has given me, you know, that new life. And I'm surrounded by positive associations. I'm always thinking about what can I do to help others. I will frequently not be able to sleep at night or in the morning. And have to go cut on my computer and write down some stuff. You know, because we're all going to die. I'm going to die one day. You're going to die one day. And after a while, when you're thinking about others, sometimes you have thoughts that come that you know these are important thoughts. These are thoughts that are meant to be shared. If you don't write them down, you may forget them. I mean, we're all human. And sometimes if you write them down, they lead to better things and they help people. And one thing that's current in my life right now is I'm involved in something called a core group. And it's come to me lately that core group is just people who are resources to Narcotics Anonymous joined together. And there have always been core group people, and there have always been members that will do service just automatically for the rest of their lives. They're that grateful. And they can answer questions, and they can give you peace and tell you what to do when you fire your sponsor prematurely. And stuff like that that you, you know, might need to know. And that is something that needs to be recognized by this fellowship, that these people are here, there, and everywhere. It's not just Bo or Bo's friends or just the people who wrote the basic text. We had an advantage, of course. I mean, we had the first equivalent of a college education in NA steps and traditions and history and service and the recovery process and how we grow and how we get together. So I wanted to start off with a pitch about the 12 step, because it's not scary up there. You can breathe the air. You can still have sex and enjoy a good dinner. And you can live up there. And you don't have to be fearful. You don't have to be vengeful. And all that crap's just behind you. And the more people know that, the sooner everything's going to get better. You know, we can learn to live in peace. But the peace comes from inside. So, thinking about in our history, if you took time out, and a lot of you have, and a lot of you will, you'll find that the whole idea of living without chemicals was probably, for our purposes, born back in the Washingtonian movement, you know, about 150 years ago, so something like that. And they failed, of course, but they made a mark, and the mark's remembered, and that's worth remembering. And then later there was the, you know, the various move zone against drinking, you know, alcohol. So that's prohibition. So it was illegal. So since it was illegal, it became profitable, and people started shooting each other over booze, which is kind of, you know, it's insanity taken to another level. And we have the privatization of incarceration for nonviolent crimes, like selling pot. And so they privatized that. Now they make these big jails out in the countryside and have a corporation to keep the people fed and housed, you know, for their crime. It'd be really nice when some of that stops. But the thing is that fresh after the anti-war movement in the 60s, all of these little scattered efforts, you know, like in New York and in L.A. and, you know, other places, I think the most important single statement as a starting point is that in 1970, can you still hear me? Did I cut some shit off? How we doing? Okay. There were 20 meetings in the world. Did it cut off again? I touched something. Help.
Let's do our handling.
How we doing? I'm not going to touch that thing again. I can learn from my actions. 20 meetings in the world. That's California, Eastern Pennsylvania, Scranton, Wilkes-Barre, and wherever else. And that came from Greg Pierce, and he was one of our early resources to fellow NA members and fellow man. And 20 meetings in the world. But it's still, you know, interesting, the things that were tried and the things that worked and the things that didn't work. And I could spend the rest of the time talking about NA before 1970. Something important things did happen, but it was small and it wasn't what I call potent. It wasn't viable. It didn't really spread. And my private fantasy, and I could be wrong about this, I'm sure, you know, somebody with a wider viewpoint, more information could come up with something better, but to me, I think that all those people that had friends killed in Vietnam and took an active part in opposing that to the point where it stopped. When they came out of that, it took me a year, I would say maybe like over 25 years clean. I've got 36 years clean now. It took me that long to realize that there was a connection between the Vietnam War and the resurgence of drug use in America. And I think it's, you know, it's between all the dope that came back to America in the body bags, plus soldiers on leave raising hell because last week they saw their friend get their face shot off and they're home for a week now. Well, you get the idea. So anyway, and I was gassed in D.C., pepper gassed, and put in jail. And I thought it was a grand experience. How honorable to be put in jail for something so worthy. And, I mean, the FBI visited my home, and I asked my parents about their boy. But, you know, that's just a hell of a thing. And so we were a little bit maybe intense, and a lot of us were college students, and Kent State wasn't lost on us. And, you know, I think, okay, in my own personal history, I didn't know anybody that knew anybody that wasn't high all the time for the whole year of 1969. We just never came down. And whatever we did, LSD was part of the show. And if you take enough acid long enough, you get what I call the toxic reaction, which you don't get high anymore. You just start feeling uncomfortable. And we had the fantasy that there was strychnine, rat poison in the LSD. But I read an underground newspaper where they researched it, and there was never any strychnine in any LSD in any city in the world. And it's the whole bullshit. You know, some addicts made that up. But it did feel like rat poison, so, you know, whatever. And I was very, I was one of those vivid, you know, addicts. And going over to Downs, I'd had friends die already shooting, you know, opiates. And so when I would think about doing opiates, I would think about rotting bodies and worms crawling out of eye sockets, and it was just not pleasant. And I'm still pretty vivid like that. And it's a great motivator in a horrible sort of way. And, you know, we could tell that there was something wrong. I mean, the pressure from Vietnam and the draft and all that, you know, all of that will make you think. It made us think. When we came out of it, like I got involved in a community service organization that I started in 1970, and I was president of it for a year and a half. And then Vietnam stopped. But we took up for hippies. I learned a lot. I found out that there was no hope anywhere on the face of the planet for addicts at all, not just addicts like us, but addicts at all. And it was very demoralizing because I think I'd always predicated that there would be an answer out there. You know, I just wasn't looking for an answer to addiction. And when I found out that there was no answer in America or Europe or Asia or China or anywhere, the Himalayas, that was mildly horrifying. I don't know if anybody can, like, really imagine how that felt. But it wasn't good. And in the middle of 71, during the wind down, and I'd moved away from the Strip in Atlanta to Buttermilk Bottoms, and I'd come across the name Narcotics Anonymous in a book on beatniks, and it sounded like an interesting name, so I thought I would call it up. And AA kind of had a good reputation. And there were no listings in the Atlanta directory, so I called AA and I asked them if they knew where there was any AA around Atlanta. And they said no, but I know a guy that I think's got a copy of their white booklet. So I eventually got a copy of that, and we held about seven meetings in Atlanta in 71. But it didn't work out. We didn't have any recovery or clean time, and didn't, you know, we did have a white booklet, but it was pretty limited if that's all you got. And so I was out there for about three more years. My clean date was in July of 1974. So by then I'd staggered on for a bit, but I'd noticed that my life was far from together. I was still just kind of insufficient. And in ways that I couldn't help, like having an itch you can't scratch. And I've always been kind of compulsively optimistic. I mean, if the goddamn world was blowing up, I'd find some kind of, like, thing to be grateful for. But, you know, that's just desperation, maybe. And I remember at the end of my fourth marriage, I think it was, sitting around and just drinking beer and just passing out every night, watching TV, having a steak, drank the beer. And the beers got bigger, and it was just a six-pack, right? But, I mean, you know, they had those six-packs of those little short-ass cans, and then they made those economical, longer cans. And then they had six-packs that actually had a couple of free beers in them. But it's still a six-pack, and you get my drift. And this guy on the Strip, it got so rough down there, I would carry a loaded six-gun after dark. I really did. And, I mean, I could draw it and shoot it fast and all that stuff. So it was just that mean down there. And, you know, anyway, my other buddy carried a 44 Magnum. And when I started the NA thing, he had started going to AA because his dad did. And we were still friends, so I went where he was because I was just tired of being alone and drinking the beer at night and being bored. So I went to this AA meeting and said hi to Jim and Rachel. And then there was a, you know, a thing where I was hearing things in their meetings that sounded mildly spiritual to me and a little bit interesting. and still thinking about addicts and what to do. And after, I think it was 60 days, he gave me a key to the building and became the coffee chairman. And about a month after I started doing that, there was an NA meeting held at the Preacher Hospital, and I went to that, and I went back every Friday night for 5 years. And within a short time, I realized that I might get like really to liking this NA thing, and that I had the heebie-jeebies because I felt like, well, hell, there you go. So you're going to damn be a big deal in the NA, and you ain't even worked your 12 steps. I mean, you're just a cheap fraud, you know, you piker. And just mumbling shit like that to myself, that's how I motivate my ass. It's very helpful to know how to motivate your ass, I found. And so for about 3 years, I just worked the hell out of the damn 12 steps. I mean, I read shit, I practiced shit. I went on a toot one time and tried to see if you could pray too much. I must have prayed about 10,000 prayers that week. But I'm lazy, so eventually I started making prayers for God to take care of me for a whole week at a time. And it worked pretty good. But you had to make other prayers for God to remind me to pray again when the lease ran out. So I had a fun 3 years. But so I got clean in 74. Well, so I went out to Northern California, which is San Francisco, to the 7th World Convention, and eventually met Greg Pierce, and he was the chairman of the board of trustees. Jimmy Kennedy says, "Hey, but Greg, here's a guy from Georgia." They were just wowed out. Somebody, "Do you got family out here? You out here on business? What's up?" He said, "I'm out here from the convention." Boy, that just flipped them out. They couldn't believe it. Because, you know, they did have 1,500 people there, but they were all from treatment centers. There was about 200 NA members, maybe three. And I mean, walking through the halls, you think, God, you know, these people would slit your throat for nothing. I mean, so this is recovery, my God. But Greg and I had real good talks, and we hit it off, and I said, who's working on the book? And he says, well, any member can. And I said, any member? Well, why haven't any members yet? So anyway, he encouraged me and sort of like trained me and taught me a lot of stuff about the service structure and all that. I remember asking him about that resource thing, you know, what does this be a resource to members? It just sounded kind of flaky. But it doesn't sound flaky today. And so he was a resource to me. And 2 years later, I was elected World Lit Chair. And what I found out was that when they hit the 40 meetings in L.A., they could climb to like 45, 46, 47, 50, 55, 56, then fall back to 30. They get to fighting among themselves. Well, really, I'm the leader. What do you mean you're the leader? I'm the leader. What do you mean you're the leader? You know, where are we going to hold the dance on the weekend? You know, they'd be damn butting heads over bullshit like that. It would kill meetings. And they couldn't get past 40 was the magic number. And so one of the things that Greg did, he got clean in 70. His story's in the white booklet. Another booklet's called I Was Different because he was in a business suit. But he could not stand to be a member of a fellowship that didn't have a service structure. And long story short, he wrote the service structure between 73 and 75. And it got approved in 75, mainly because he was on the Board of Trustees and he kept bugging them to approve it. And I don't even think they'd read it, but they finally just approved it to get him off their damn back. And so he tried to get the conference started, this outlined, and the honorable and polite last chapter in the NA tree says, "The structure described in this booklet does not yet exist." But we're hoping that it will exist someday, and maybe this booklet will help it exist. So they tried to hold the first World Service Conference in I think, you know, 76, it was approved in 75, no go. 77, I was there. The, you know, it's 400 miles involved. So the RSR from Southern California drove to Northern California, but the RSR from Northern California could not make it across town. So the proposed WSC was canceled for that year. Well, that pissed off Greg so bad that the next year he came in with a bundle of enabling motions to establish the World Service Conference. And it basically is a process where you get down and say, we, the following regions, declare we will support the World Service Conference. And I think they had two, maybe three. And they would let anybody vote. A member showed up from, a newcomer from New Jersey showed up and voted at the World Service Conference, then got a job at WSO and didn't even go back to New Jersey to make his report to the two or three meetings they had. And but that was just necessary. That's how hard they wanted to get the World Service Conference going. And they realized wisely that if some one member were to come from a state, then hell, the next year a bunch of members would show up. So that worked pretty good. So we had people, but we only had three meetings, I think, three regions until around 81 or 82, something like that, which is wild. But I was, I served as vice chair that year, and we went from three regions at the World Service Conference to 28, and you know, that year. So it's like a great leap forward. So what all happened, this is like history of NA stuff, because everything I'm saying involves people, people like you and me. Before the book, before the WSC, before the service structure, remember getting past 40, people would contend. When they had a service structure, they had a way to sit and meet in a non-toxic spiritual setting. And they could share concerns and pool resources and get results for their members and their groups. That was the basic idea of service. And when you're really doing service, it feels great. If you're involved with something, it doesn't feel joy like in your heart and stuff. It's not service. You know, something's gone wrong. It's been co-opted. The titles can be there. But, you know, real service is giving. And it feels real good. And it gives you energy and stuff. So in the years between 78 and 81 or 82, I think there were 20 meetings in the world in 1970 and around 250, maybe 300 in the mid-70s. And we just started growing. And I would handle this differently if this was a story of the basic text talk, but I'm going to just say that the people that came to the LIT conferences between 79, 80, 81, and 82, I guess, early part, but they went home and started 10,000 meetings because NA stopped being a hearsay phenomenon. And these people had a college education in writing and studying and learning about and comparing notes. And when you're in a room, let's say, well, how many we got here? Was this 100, 120? Okay, imagine, say, 100 people in the room and you read a document and anybody in the room can challenge your question part of the reading. And we go over it word by word, line by line, paragraph by paragraph, page by page. And we read the whole damn thing, and you mark your own copy. Everybody in the room's got a copy of it. And then it's like, does anybody got, okay, take your break, come back. Okay, welcome back. Has anybody got any marks on page one? Okay, back there on the last row. And it turns out five people have marked a single word, a single sentence. Well, that's how we changed it. And that's a real good method, you know, because it includes everybody, and everybody's got their focus and their attention. And we are such picky, picky, picky people. I mean, we're not too picky before we get here qualifying, but you take a dope out of us, we really go insane. And it's all that pickiness, you know, that composed your basic text. So when you hear about Bow wrote the basic text, well, that's just like a really short way of saying Bow got to be the slave and a willing servant of hundreds of people, and basically North America, who wanted very much for addicts to stop dying. And he was always glad to be their slave and do just what they said. In fact, he didn't even feel less of a man to surrender and do what he was told. He thought that was worthy and proper. It's only a recovering acid head can make it. And, you know, the love is very real to us. And seeing people dynamic and verbal and literate and having a dream come true, that just turned my ass on. So that's how I got my kicks. And after the first conference, we used to say something special to them. We would say, "You, wherever you were in the hierarchy that you came here from, you are now the most informed member in your area or region. And so when you get home, they ain't telling you what to do. We respect you. But if you go home and just start crowing and shooting your mouth off, they're going to hate you. And if you keep it up, they might drag you outside and kick your ass. And the smartest thing to do is just go home and be polite. And we're sending you with bunches and bunches of evidence to take home and give to people so they'll read it and get curious and want to know more. And when they want to know more, it's okay to start talking, you know. But don't talk, you know. They'll think that you're just egotistical and nuts and rude, and which you are, you know. It's rude to intrude and ask, right? Like if you go in the bathroom, somebody kicks the door down, that's rude. And a lot of these, when I talk about hierarchies and leadership and all that, I mean the people that really keep an NA such as it is back home in, you know, 1970 whatever, 80s something, they really were holding down the fort. So if they felt undercut or threatened, they weren't necessarily being egotistical. They were looking out for the people that looked to them. And after a while you start getting like, you know, this 3D vision, maybe 4D. And you know, so be calm when you go home and be polite. And, you know, people come up and want to know, and you can talk your ass off. But they have to make the first move. And it's still sort of like that today because we're all fighting for our lives. And we're all capable of going nuts. You know, if we lose a grip, it can be real life-threatening. So you got to be careful like that. But the point is that the whole movement just spread Narcotics Anonymous in writing. And you know what happened? Before the book, two or three members would come together in a town out in Kansas and start a meeting. And within a year or so, they may get 5 or 10 local addicts coming in for meetings. And then they'd fuss and fight and get loaded, every one of them. And the people that had come in for recovery would just go get loaded too, because what else do you do? And it would just start up and die out, start up and die out, start up and die out. That happened everywhere. And the basic text of Narcotics Anonymous stopped all that. One, you know, maybe somebody would get loaded, but it might not be one of the two or three. And if they did, the people left still had a book. They still had a meeting. And the recovery process is still growing like that. That basic dynamic. That's like a, you know, I was a biology major at Georgia State, and, you know, there's plant kingdom and animal kingdom, and then the animal kingdom, you have a lot of different critters that have cellular tissue like ours, but only certain ones have backbones. And so we're all vertebrates. And the, you know, the evolution of it all, you know, we've come to a marvelous place. I mean, modern technology, the computers have expanded the mind of people. I mean, we're off planet to a certain extent now, but we're trapped on the planet Earth until we learn to deal with our addictions. We've had a lot of great spiritual leaders, you know, and throughout history, But Narcotics Anonymous is the only one that's really taken on addiction as a disease and gotten any results at all. So please go out there and break some more ground, will you? Because if you don't, we'll all start fussing and kill each other. And I'd a lot rather be clean and having fun and breaking new ground. You know, when we're thinking about the other guy, we're pretty sensible. When we get selfish and we're just thinking about ourselves, we get fucking nuts. And, you know, when you're loving and caring and kind like that, God flows through your body. You can experience that. And you realize it's God doing it, it ain't your ego. And it won't make you sick. And you won't do crazy, mean things that you'll feel bad about later on. So the history basically started with a couple of addicts thinking that it might be neat to be able to live clean. And they finally sold a third person, man or woman. Let's close that door back there. We'll probably be done in a few minutes. Kind of hard for them to close it while they're standing in it. But, we had some meetings here and there, and Greg came along, and he's the father of our service structure. There are other things to do. I mean, you'll hear people occasionally say, well, I think we got enough books. We don't need any more books. Well, I tell you, the books are a hedge against insanity. We need all the books we can get. And the only reason somebody don't want a book is because they're lazy and they don't want to have to read it. And also, they don't want anybody catching it, whatever bullshit they're caught doing. So they don't want another book. But my advice, you need another book. And you need a book on conduct and what society is and what the disease is. Why not have it? Imagine, I've got a 600-page book here. Oh, the disease concept of addiction. Oh, whoops, it hadn't happened yet. Thank you.